The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And you know what? We think we hate all this uncertainty and everything, and we think we want to know. And then you find out and you go, oh God, I wish I didn't find that out. So there seems to have been a pincer movement coming from various quarters to tell us what's in store for us in 2021. So, for example, the Sunday Independent is leading with lockdown could last past April. Schools and construction sites might reopen before March if the numbers are okay. Could be the summer before bars, restaurants and hotels are able to reopen in any way. While any form of international tourism from overseas this year is being ruled out. This is, I think, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said this in a private meeting with the hospitality industry last week. He said to them, the virus keeps ripping up our plans. It could be autumn before wet pubs open. And a source saying, I doubt hospitality will open before the summer. The strategy, according to one senior figure, is hope for the best, but plan for the worst. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a poll saying voters are losing faith in the COVID coalition. But they have a story that will be of interest to a lot of people inside, is that they are saying that basically, schools wise, the plan might be they might get the leaving certs back for February 1st, hopefully. The rest of the schools, it will be February 22nd. So February 15th, I think there's a midterm break at that stage. So they're saying give it the midterm break and then get the rest of them back. I mean, hopefully on February 22nd. The Business Post has a great lead story, a bit of proactivity for a change. We're being a bit proactive instead. You know, it feels as if we're sometimes quite reactive to the vaccination thing, because we're saying, well, you know, we're dependent on supply and what are you going to do? State in bid to stock up on AstraZeneca vaccine ahead of approval. So the idea would be that it would be in situ at vaccination centres and GP clinics ahead of the European market authorisation. Because you would think, if we're talking about Noel, Colm Henry said yesterday, we're going to be looking at restrictions for the rest of the year. If that's the alternative, well, then we need to, I don't know, the world. I know there are all these reasons why we can't, but everybody needs to get more urgent about vaccinations. It's the only path out of this now and the only alternative to being shut down for the year. Business Post also has, there's a lot of very good stuff in the papers today about the mother and baby so-called homes. The Business Post is saying that up to 130,000 survivors may be eligible for the redress scheme. And I think everyone's just waiting for that redress scheme to be cocked up like others have been. But look, hopefully not. That story points out that there could be another 25,000 unmarried mothers plus a larger number of children in other county homes which were not investigated. And like, it does sound like those county homes were awful places altogether, in many cases worse than, much worse than the religious run homes. The Sunday Times HSE predicts UK strain to cause 70% of new cases, which I suppose, it will. And they have Colm Henry saying yesterday that we face another year of restrictions. They also have, so the latest is that the lawyers, they want to be bumped up the vaccination list. They deserve an early vaccine, they say, the ones that have to go into emergency court sittings and things like that. So look, everybody, I'm sure, in their own heads has a great case here to get bumped up the list. And then Justine McCarthy has a story, doctor paid thousands for mother and baby home trials. So that is like, that is vaccination trials that went on in this country. And obviously, no consent. And I think the report found that none of the children were harmed. But Justine has a very good comprehensive forensic piece inside. And it would seem to call that into question. The Irish Sunday Mirror, HSE call in the army. So the army are now doing non-clinical general duties in nursing homes in Ballincollig, in Douglas and Cork, and in Ennis and Clare. And it makes sense, doesn't it? And I think the army are very ready and willing to help in this in any way they can. And they have been assisting in any way they can. The Sunday World Daniel's ban mail, we revealed the secret government emails to UAE and Saudi officials that KO'd Daniel Kinahan's boxing dream. The Irish Sun on Sunday, DNA key to nail Paul Monsters, cops launch new probe into brutal killing. So this is the story of Paul Quinn. Paul Quinn, you will remember, was beaten to death when he was 21 by a gang in a shed in Castle Blaney in County Monaghan in 2007. I think, if I remember correctly, every bone in his body was broken. His family believed that he was murdered after he got in a row, I think, with the son of a local senior IRA man. So it seems that the Gardaí are still hoping to get to the bottom of that. And just to annoy you, the Sunday Telegraph in England, basically every adult in Britain will be vaccinated by the end of June. So there you go. Our panel this morning, Dr. Laura Durkin is a consultant rheumatologist in Beaumont Hospital. Mark Little is an entrepreneur, former journalist and CEO of Kinzen. And Stephen Kinsella, who is socially distanced down in Limerick, is associate professor of economics at UL. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And now, before we go any further, guys, could I ask you all to put on your headphones for a minute? And we're just going to go to the story of the mother and baby homes, the commission and the report. In lots of ways, it's only building and building as a story. And Regina Doherty, leader of the Shannon, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Regina, you were tweeting last night that you said, "I agree the Commission's report should not be let stand as our nation's response to the women and their children's experiences." Why do you think that?
I don't think it's good enough. I think the report, and I say that in isolation, obviously it's a body of work and it does detail an enormous amount of factual evidence, but it's cold, it's legalistic. In places, Brendan, it's callous. I don't think it should be the nation's only response to our women and their children and their lived experiences. I think the mantra of no evidence completely ignores the testimony of the women's lived experiences. When we asked these women to come forward and to share their experiences so that we could listen to them. And I think in places, in lots of places, the Commission's report feels like we only listened to them to reply. We didn't listen to them to hear them or to heal them. I mean, we don't say that we believe them. In places in the report, we tell the women that their memories are inaccurate, that they're plain wrong. It's not good enough. It's not good enough to stand alone as the nation's response to generations of women who were mistreated. And there's a whole lot of other words that could be used at the hands of the church and the state. And I think it should be independently reviewed. And it may be just that the terms of reference, Brendan, were too legalistic and it maybe shouldn't have been, you know, judicially led. But it certainly has compounded years and years and years of hurt. And it isn't what the women expected this week. And I think we've done them a huge disservice. The report suggests in places that the women weren't expected or asked to do anything that they weren't expected or asked to do in their own family homes. The women in Bessbrook were put on their hands and knees and made cut the grass with scissors. They were worked to their bones. These women who were heavily pregnant or post-pregnant were treated like absolute, like in so many places, this compounds the hurt of what these women, and actually I shouldn't even use that term because that's the term that's used entirely through the report, these women. They weren't these women. They were our four ancestors. The women that are alive today are related or are friends with people that everybody knows. These are Irish people, Irish children, and this report does it a huge disservice to treat them with language that's so callous and that's cold and that completely lacks in empathy. And I don't think it's good enough to stand as our nation's response to our women, and I think it should be reviewed. And I think our nation's response should be entirely different to the lived experiences. And the very least we should say to these women is that we absolutely believe them. And what happened to them was horrendously and awfully wrong. And that our actions obviously now should show how much and how deeply sorry we are for the treatment at the hands of the church and the state through generations of these women.
Which the Taoiseach did do on behalf of the state and on behalf of, I think, everybody last week.
I think Micheál Martin is probably one of the most empathetic and caring men that we have in politics. And I've seen him firsthand deal with particularly women who've been sexually abused or abused, and he absolutely enormously can. But we accepted the report, and I think that's wrong. I don't know any woman, and Brendan, they've been on the airwaves all week, the women that are brave enough to come forward and tell how they feel. There's not a single survivor or children of those survivors that are happy with the contents of the report. Imagine inviting women to come across and share their experiences with you and then telling them that their memories are wrong, that they're inaccurate. Imagine setting the tone to say that, well, you know, the reason that babies got sick so often is because we allowed mini epidemics to occur because they were all put together. It was because of our inactions that these children got sick. It's because of the actions of the people who ran the homes that allowed them to be in situations where they could catch infectious diseases, and our lack of interventions caused them to die. It wasn't just an occurrence or an accident.
What do you propose to do about this, Regina?
The Shannon is returning on Tuesday, and the only business that we have on Tuesday is with Minister Roderick O'Gorman, and I am going to ask him to independently review, to have a document that actually acknowledges with empathy, with care, with understanding of the real lived experiences of these women, and maybe sets the path going forward to the reparations that I know the state, and I know you said in your opening that everybody expects us to muck it up, but we absolutely can't muck it up. And if there's anything, we should be doubly down determined to make sure that we don't, because of the coldness and the hurt that we compounded this week by the report that when it was published.
So what would a review look like? Are you talking about another report? Because I suppose in a way you say it's cold and legalistic and everything. That was clearly how it was set up to be in one way. So do we need another process here whereby the women are heard?
Well, I'm not being critical of the report or the people who wrote the report just for the sake of it. And it isn't another five-year process that I'm looking for. And yes, you're right, and I said it at the beginning, that maybe the terms of reference were too legalistic. But the language that's used in the report, whilst might be acceptable, you know, in legal terms, the term illegitimate, calling the women these women, I don't know whether we meant offence by that, but offence was taken and offence was caused. And so some other national response has to be able to sit either on top of or beside this report that absolutely acknowledges with empathy and with care and showing that we really, really did listen, that we heard the women. Some report that has to be able to start the healing process, because this, what we did this week, didn't go any way towards healing.
So you are suggesting that we reject this report?
Well, as the only unique response from the Irish nation, I don't accept it. And that's not to say that it obviously wasn't a huge, humongous amount of work on both the people who commissioned and the ladies that came forward and gave their testimony. But it isn't a true reflection of Irish society today. We all know how Irish society was framed and was held in the grip of both the state and the church at the time. And maybe that compounded people's actions, or, you know, maybe it explains why and how they did. But today's society, I think we deserve, our ladies who shared their view with us, I think they deserve a better response from today's society.
Okay, Regina, maybe stay with us. And I want to bring in Katrina Crowe, archivist and broadcaster. Now, Katrina, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
You think that the authors of the report really need to come out and explain themselves now?
I do. I'd like to echo a lot of what Regina said. There's mounting disquiet, particularly among survivors, about the report. Now that people have had a chance to partially see it, it is 3,000 pages long. I myself, who am very interested in it, have not managed to finish reading it yet. I estimate it will take an entire month at 100 pages a day to read the report. So that caveat has to be there for all of us who comment on it. And first, it is indeed a very great research achievement. There are very good parts of this report. The historical context piece is written by professional historians. It's very helpful in looking at the whole issue of these mother and baby homes and unmarried mothers generally in the context of 20th century Ireland. There's a very valuable listing of the archives consulted by the Commission in the course of their inquiry. But the major piece of this report is the witnesses' testimony, the people who came forward, 550 of them to the confidential committee, to give testimony about very traumatic experiences to the commission. And the conclusions that are drawn by the report, such as there were no forced adoptions, no evidence of physical abuse, Irish society at large responsible rather than laying the blame squarely on church and state, are bizarre, given that the evidence itself, and I'll come to what's wrong with that in a moment, does not bear them out.
Can I ask you a couple of things about that, Katrina?
You can, of course, yeah.
In terms of the testimony, so-called, is there an issue around this, that this was not actually sworn testimony? Is that why it's not being regarded as evidence? But then on the other hand, when we have in the past had sworn testimony, does that bring you into an adversarial kind of situation, which nobody wants either? So was there a bit of a catch-22 here in terms of it being evidence?
Well, perhaps. I'm not a lawyer, and it would be one of the reasons it would be very, very interesting to hear from the three commissioners who have so far refused to comment on the report or to give a press conference and tell us what their thinking was. They would be able to answer that question as to how that influenced the way that they have dealt with the testimony. The problem is that people went in and spoke for, in some cases, 2 hours to the commission. They were asked if it was all right if they were taped. Most gave consent to that. The only person that I know who has managed so far to get a copy of her testimony from the commission, which most survivors requested numerous times over the last 5 years, and they refused point blank to give it, is Noelle Brown, who was on your colleague Claire Burns' programme last mm-hmm. Wednesday, when she had finally got a copy of it. When she got it, she found that it wasn't, as she expected, a transcript of what she said, but a number of questions that she had not been told she was going to ask, laid out like a template. Those boxes were ticked, and every now and again there was a little box with some of her own words in it. That is not what she was told was going to happen. She was given no copy of these questions that clearly the commission asked every survivor when they came into them, and she was absolutely dismayed when she saw it. It does not concord with her memory of what she said on the day, and the commission itself got very, very important facts wrong. Like, for example, they say in the transcript that she was raised by her birth parents. She was adopted at 8 weeks old in Bessborough. These things are hurtful, wrong, and against best practice.
Okay.
Then when we come to the actual confidential committee part of the report, instead of getting, as you'd expect, and you should get, in situations like this, the words of the survivors themselves, they would, of course, have to be edited for length. And if proper practice had been followed, those transcripts of the full evidence would have been made, and people would have gone back to the survivors to check with them that that transcript was accurate, to check with them if it could be edited, and to check again when the edited transcript was there. Hard work, granted, but well worthwhile, because what it bespeaks is respect for the people who are giving the evidence. It's going to be very, very difficult for survivors to identify their own evidence in this report, because most of what they said is paraphrased. In other words, the narrative is the narrative of the commission, who are telling us what the women said to them. She said, he said, with bits of quotation from the survivors, quite small numbers of them, in
Katrina,
the body of the text. Now, this is really serious.
Katrina, because I'm conscious that I have a panel and other things to deal with as
course,
well. So I'm sorry,
and
I don't mean to, you know, in any way denigrate the importance of what you're saying. What needs to happen now?
What needs to happen now is that all survivors should be given copies of their testimony. They should always have got it. Then they are going to have to undergo the painful process of comparing that testimony with what they said themselves at the original meeting and with what's in the report. And at that point, there may have to be a serious review of what the report found. We can keep the valuable bits and deal separately with the issue of what was done to the survivors. And I really hope, and I would again call for the commissioners to come out and talk to the Irish people, and particularly to the survivors, about why they did what they did.
Okay.
What was their methodology? Sean Ryan did that when he launched the Industrial Schools Report in 2009. Absolutely transparent, gave a press conference, answered questions. Could the commissioners please do that now as soon as possible so that answers can be got to these pressing questions?
Katrina, can I ask you a question before you go? I think one of the issues that a lot of people were bothered about this week was that this notion of blaming society and not placing the full blame on the the church and the state, which I think, in fairness, the church and the state did get its share of blame. But I think as people get a chance to read the report now, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the papers today. I believe, I haven't read the report myself, but I believe there is a chapter in it about attitudes, and that there does seem to have been a societal, call it an economic background. Gerard Howland is writing about this today, Michael Brennan in the Business Post, Owen Harris and Jody Corcoran in the Sunday Independent, that I think Jody Corcoran quotes Joe Lee, that the church was merely a reflection of the dominant economic values of post-famine rural society, and that the economic consequences of an illegitimate child in terms of how it affected marriage prospects, inheritance, the holding together of small holdings, that as Gerard Howland says, this was brutally enforced because it needed to be for economic reasons. So was there a societal complicitness in it all?
Yes, of course there was, but you have to wonder where those ideas came from in the first place. Basically, what you're looking at after 1922 is a very, very powerful, highly puritanical Catholic Church that is in a unique position to take a huge amount of power in the running of the state. The elected government hands over to them the running of health, education, institutional so-called care, which they deliver to millions of our citizens, and in some cases still do today. What you have is a church that's really interested in sexuality to a creepy degree, where sex, transgressive sex, is the biggest sin. It's worse than violence. It's worse than political misconduct, than a whole host of other things. And anybody who read Dermot Farrish's column yesterday in the Irish Times will see the context of this, that you regularly have priests denouncing from the altar girls who became pregnant outside marriage, women who became pregnant outside marriage, that there's an absolutely closed feedback loop between the ideology of the Catholic Church, yes, granted, the economic interests of certain people, but by no means all. We did have a smallholder peasant society created by the Land Commission who transferred land to Irish tenants, which was a good thing, before 1922. And respectability becomes all important. And it's all there in the literature. You look at John B. Keane's Scythe, you look at Tom Murphy's Bally Gongora, all of those wonderful pieces of drama which demonstrated to the Irish people what they were like. That's all there. But the people who actually had the power, and the power, if they wished to change the way they were operating, were the church and the state. And the state handed over power to the church, who did not create other options for women with difficult pregnancies. And they could have.
Okay, thanks for that, Katrina. Regina, would you agree with Katrina that should the authors of the report come out now and explain themselves?
I think it would be a helpful process, but I still don't think explaining why it's as cold and as callous as it stands on its own 2 feet is going to form any part of a healing process. You know, what I want and what I'd love to see is some review, or maybe as Katrina says, maybe we'll accept some parts of it and you know, change other parts of it. Somebody with the heart to actually listen. Somebody with an empathetic bone in their body to listen to the experiences and tell these women, we believe them.
Regina, let's be careful now about suggesting that the people who did the report were callous or anything, or that they didn't have an empathetic bone in their body. I'm sure they did, but, you know, they had a job to do here and it was set up in a particular way. So, you know, I'm not defending the report or anything, but let's be mindful of being balanced about this as well. Katrina and Regina, maybe stay with me. And to bring in the panel, Laura, I suppose I barely kind of remember the dying embers of that Ireland. You're much younger than me. What has struck you about the stories we've been hearing in the past week?
So I think that the narratives from the women who were in those homes, which were in the papers across multiple papers today, very much mirror the kind of narratives that you see in hospitals when you meet these women at the far end of this, where they've been through these horrible traumatic experiences that they've never managed to get over, and that as a result of that they have lots of chronic health issues and lots of psychological and issues that have haunted them their whole lives. And I suppose I hear both, obviously Katrina and Regina both have very very good points about this, but I suppose I want to look to provide solutions. It's not always helpful for us to say, to diagnose a cancer, for example, and then to not give us a plan going forward or not give any form of, you know, healing for these women. And I suppose the you know, if their testimony, be it sworn or otherwise, is inaccurate in this report, then obviously that needs to be edited. Well, a report can't go out, albeit that they're not named in it. But if they see inaccuracies in their testimony, they should be able to rectify those. And I suppose perhaps some kind of narrative reporting around their individual stories may be healing for them, in addition to whatever redress system they come to. But I think for those women to be able to move forward from this report, there has to be, you know, a plan, a road out of it, because we've just described the most horrendous misery that they had to endure with a church and a society and in collusion against them in the most misogynistic and horrendous way.
And may I say, the medical community, Micheál Martin said last week, and I thought it was quite a pithy summing up of it, the priest, the nun and the doctor were never far away from most of these stories.
Absolutely.
And doctors had huge power around this country back then as well, didn't they?
They did. I mean, these babies were delivered by doctors, they were delivered by midwives, they were delivered by, these are like, there's almost no section of our healthcare, our church, our society in general that isn't culpable in some way for this. And it's our job now to make this better, and also to have a good hard look at ourselves and make sure that we're not repeating the sins of our past now. And I hope that this will give us some kind of building blocks where people can look to move forward from it, rather than kind of wallow, that we all wallow in it now. They need a road out, and I hope that it can be provided to them.
Okay, Mark Little.
Yeah, the words that I've been listening to here, like power, that's the centrality of all this. This idea that is it between the church and the state to blame, or society? The fact was, the lived experience in Ireland, and I'm old enough to remember the early 70s in my education, my society around me, was that power was vested in what Colm Tobin talks about today as a shadow state. And it had a dominance over the culture, a dominance over the society. And I think Katrina is right to sort of talk about the feedback loop of that. So the idea that we are now, unfortunately, I think, being asked to choose between blaming state and the church or society ourselves, and not seeing the things, they're totally meshed together as far as I would be concerned. And the worst thing, I think, would be that we regard this as history. It's not history. And the word survivor, I think, is so crucial to all of this. It's a lived experience. I don't think there's a family in this country that is not touched in some way by this, even still today. And for that reason, I think the only solution, aside from redress and the information for those survivors about the circumstances of birth, for example, is total transparency, and to make sure this is the beginning of something and not the end. For me, that would be the ultimate repudiation of what I think Hugh O'Connell said it today in the Sunday Independent. He said, you know, at our most Catholic, we were at our least Christian. And I think that has to be recognised, not just blaming us, but saying this is the beginning of a redress, the beginning of a process. It's not history. It's lived experience. It explains an awful lot about our country.
Yeah. Stephen Kinsella.
I'm really struck by the comments of the previous speakers. I think if you define power as the capacity to act, well, the people who had the power in the era that the report covers was the church and the state. And if you think about what we had the power to do, we had the power to create a process that was far more human and empathetic, as Regina says, and we didn't. We have the power to put in place another process that is that empathetic. And I think that's maybe what we should think about doing, perhaps through an Oireachtas committee. I absolutely agree with Laura as well. You can't have a situation where people are producing reports with factual inaccuracies in it. So that again provides a process whereby things can be changed. But one thing I think people listening need to understand is that there still have to be consequences, not simply redress, but actual consequences. And you only get that when you have a good picture of what's going on. So Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Independent is very good because it shows how systematic all of it was, how large scale, how national all of it was. And even today, you know, most of the dioceses and congregations are charities, but they're not companies in this country. And Section 52 of the Charities Act says that they have to file company accounts with the charities regulator, but the Section 54 of the Charities Act says that the charity regulator should publish all of the materials from all the charities. In other words, how much they're earning from the state. So you're talking about all the Roman Catholic Church, all the major congregations, and the charities regulator has not done so. So we're not talking about small amounts of money, Brennan. We're talking about €1 billion or more every year. We don't know how much money they're making from the state. And when it comes to consequences, as Hugh O'Connell shows, you need a systematic broad-based view. So the 186 largest of these charities that are not companies, that the Charities Act places an obligation on the regulator to publish the accounts. We don't know. The public actually don't have access to that data. Okay. And I think if the words of what we've heard today are for anything, if there's one major word, it's transparency. And I think I think next week we should absolutely see the charities regulator being asked, what are those data? Are you going to publish it? Will you give us a time series of that data? How much is the state paying these organizations? What are the value of their assets? What's the value of their liabilities? We want to see what they're worth, because then we want to calculate the reparations that are due to over 100,000 people, you know? And I think that's a really key step here, because like many you know, I suppose I grew up in the sort of post Mary Rafferty States of Fear kind of Ireland, you know. And like many, I've spent most of my adult life being shocked at the conduct of the church, and also shocked at the paucity of consequences. And I go back to what I said at the start. Power is the capacity to act. We have the power to act. We have the capacity to act. We just need the willingness to act. And I'd like to see that happening next week.
Regina, Stephen brings up an interesting point there, which is that if you are in this country disadvantaged, disabled, disenfranchised, dis-anything else, you are more than likely still going to end up being pointed to something that is run by the church to get your services in a lot of cases, and that the state is funneling an enormous amount of money through a lot of these orders still, aren't they?
I think in the last number of years, and this is by no means as an excuse, Brendan, and we're certainly still have a long, long way to go, the state has tried to change and to tip the balance of the provision of services away from what was historically religious organisations, with the likes of our Section 38 and 39 service level agreements, and that are now bound by contracts. Rory Quinn attempted to try and change the balance of the provision of education, and actually in a lot of cases was stopped, you know, by the wishes of parents in towns and villages, of changing schools from being Catholic run. But the schools today, I believe, are very different to the schools that Brennan, you and I would have went to. So, albeit my children go to Catholic schools, the vast majority of them, I don't think there's a nun or a priest to be seen, you know. But that's not to say that that's not people's choice, and they still obviously have the choice, and we can see as more schools are coming on board, they are Educate Together schools or multi-denominational schools. But we have a long way to go, because that power that Stephen talks about, that's so deep-rooted in the foundation of our state, the fawning of each other between the church and the state at that stage, that gave that grip and that control. And we all lived under the fear of that domination and that, you know, retribution of what that power yielded at the time. Now today, society is educated and we're far more, you know, sprightly than we would have been, and don't accept things. And maybe Mark will tell you that's somewhat going, you know, too far the other way. But at least we're strong enough now to stand up and say what's wrong. And what happened this week is wrong. And I don't accept that it should be our nation's response to our women's lived experiences. I'm sorry. And I didn't mean to be disrespectful to the body of work that's been done, but I don't accept a lot of the assertions in it. And neither do the survivors.
Okay. Regina Doherty, thank you very much. Katrina Crowe, thank you as well for joining us. And Dr. Laura Durkin and Mark Little and Stephen Kinsler will stay with us. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Mark Little, Stephen Kinsler and Dr. Laura Durkin still with us. Dr. Laura Durkin, have you got your vaccine?
So I have been shot up, Brendan, and it was like the best present that I have ever received in my life. So I was, I got my vaccine at work in the first week of rollout. It made me realise that actually I've spent the last 12 months imagining every morning when I wake up that I have some form of COVID until I have a cup of coffee and then my day starts and I realise that actually maybe I don't have COVID. And the fear that had been hanging over me at work for the past year was actually enormous. And once I had the vaccine, now obviously the vaccine isn't immediate and you wait a couple of weeks for your antibodies and you get a second dose. But it has been a cloud that has been lifted from me and enabled me to continue my work without this massive fear. And I cannot wait for it to be something that's extended to everybody, because I feel like a normal person now, whereas I can now look back on November or last March and say, God, I was really worried all the time about whether or not I would get it or give it to somebody or whether I'd be a vector on my ward. I suppose all of this was kind of compacted by the fact that I'm heavily pregnant at the moment.
Did you have any hesitancy, so to speak? Because I see like under 18s and pregnant women are down the bottom of the list, aren't they, pending kind of further research?
Listen, Brendan, this brings me straight back to, you know, the misogyny of this world. I was horrified when I saw that list, and my poor bosses at work,
at least they're not treating pregnancy as an underlying condition. They didn't put you up on the list.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We have had some sick pregnant women in the third trimester with COVID coming into our hospitals. It's not nothing. And certainly the thought that I would get sick and that I would end up in isolation in a hospital, it's extreme. It made me very anxious, and it's almost impossible to, for example, resuscitate a pregnant woman because they're so, you can't get down on their chest. If I'm in a major hospital and something dreadful happens to me, I don't know that there'd be someone there who could even cut out my baby. So I had huge anxiety about developing horrible COVID in pregnancy. And I suppose for me, I extensively read up the literature. My husband read up the literature. And I was like, God, you know, this vaccine does not get into cells. This baby is cooked. You know, I need to be a healthy mother to the children that I have and the child that I'm going to have. And I want to continue to be a productive doctor. So for me, it was an absolute no-brainer. And I wanted to be there for that dose. And I was so happy to get it.
And what do you think about, there's a lot of various back and forth now between staff working in private hospitals, working in public hospitals. Then there's, you know, talk about people who are pen pushers in hospitals are getting it as well. And, you know, there's all kinds of skirmishes around the edges of this. What are your thoughts on that?
So I suppose the first thing for me is that, like, obviously I feel massive relief, but this isn't a present to me for being a public servant or serving patients. This is actually me keeping patients safe. So, like, nosocomial or hospital-acquired COVID, Brendan, has been, like, an absolute nightmare in our hospitals. And part of me being vaccinated is that we hope that I can no longer now transmit COVID to one of my patients, make them sick and then subsequently die. So it's wrong for us to think that vaccinating the frontline workers is somehow a reward for the year that they've had. And so it's actually a protection for the patients. So no matter where you are, if you see patients who are Irish citizens and deserve to be safe in their healthcare setting, you should be vaccinated. I don't care what hospital you work in. You look after Irish people. You shouldn't be able to give them COVID, hopefully. So you should be in PPE and you should be vaccinated. Yeah. And I don't think it matters whether you are a HSE employee or whether you're not. You're still looking after Irish patients. So I don't think it should be seen as a reward, nor should it be seen as a poker card in some negotiation that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Mark, you're an entrepreneur, big picture thinking, kind of sciencey kind of guy and all that. We're like, you know, the league tables, I'm sure we won't want to talk about them next week when we're number 10, but we are apparently doing the best per head in Europe at the moment. Is this going well, do you think, or not?
The first thing is, let's not go to this league table nonsense. Like, it's like the Eurovision Song Contest. We're just behind Denmark, which is, you know, not as good as Israel. Yeah. Like, it's just crazy because it's not recognizing that the three things, I think, in all of this, the government have to resolve is, like, the first is preparation. And that's why the story this morning about the AstraZeneca going for that particular vaccine is really interesting. And the second is ambiguity, right? So for me personally, I covered the last financial crisis in 2008, and the one thing we haven't recognised that's very different to our last crisis is back then we were totally powerless, right? Remember, I mean, the solution was we take more pain from the Troika and the government. Now, the solution depends on each one of us as active citizens, you know, actually respecting the advice, it's not travelling. We're decentralising power over our work and our education, and to an extent, you know, going out and phoning up the GP, myself and Laura were talking about this earlier on. So it's actually down to us as active citizens to be part of the solution. Mm. And I think that's why when I see a lot of the coverage today, it's not recognising that this is a very different crisis. Our expectations of government, our expectations of our lives have totally changed. We were told we couldn't do anything about the education or health system, and literally, in the blink of an eye, you know, our kids are being homeschooled and we're all working from home. So I think there's something happening underlying this in Irish society that we should be recognising a lot more. This is
this
not
is the notion
crisis.
Of a pandemic pressing fast forward on history. In a,
yeah,
in a way.
And then all of this becoming more comfortable with the ambiguity of life, you know? Like, that's part of it. Not a league table. Are we doing well this week or tomorrow? It's like, no, no, there's an ambiguity here. We're not all in this together. My 5K is very different to someone living in a, you know, a tower block in, you know, West Dublin with kids and they're young. But at the same time, we all want to be in this together. Our superpower is solidarity. So there's something here, I think, for the government to resolve is maybe preparing ourselves, not for the worst, but for things will happen that will change. A vaccine may not be as effective as one other vaccine. Legislation may happen. A variant might emerge. So I think probably the best thing we can do right now is prepare ourselves for the ambiguity of all this.
And stop having explosions of outrage and tears every time things don't go our way again.
There's a role for that. Yeah. But at the same time, it's not a policy or a strategy. That's a reaction. And there's really positive things happening right now that will change society in a way I don't think we've yet discussed properly.
Yeah. Give me one example of how things might change for the better.
So the expectation of what we can solve as people. Right. So we're told that we can't solve. Like, you know, remember, the Department of Health was Angola because it was so famously insoluble. Right. Education, work, the expectation that we will expect the state to give us power, that should be the goal of the state. And, you know, not to bring up the previous discussion we just had, but we had a shadow state rule this country. There was no decentralization to citizens. We were not citizens. We were voters. We were subjects. We were believers. Now we're citizens. So personally, I think there is actually going to be, in terms of our work, the way we work, the expectations of broadband, the expectations of travel, the end to the nightmare of the commute, the way we live in cities. These are all going to fundamentally change in a way that we haven't seen in certainly living memory. And I would argue for, you know, this kind of shift in the pandemic world is going to change everything. And I think our expectations of what we can do to change things like climate, to change our transport system, we will demand a lot more, I think, because we've seen what happens when the power is in our hands.
Yeah. Stephen Kinsler, what do you think?
I'd agree with Mark that, you know, that the international league table Eurovision thing is a waste of time. I think it's fine to compare how you're doing, as long as it doesn't become either a stick to beat the government with or a clap on the back. I think there's two numbers that matter, the cumulative number of people who are vaccinated and the rate of that change. You
tweeted an interesting blog yesterday about, they were quite simple in a way, the lessons from Israel. It was really good. Just can you share that a bit with people?
Well, basically there were three major lessons. The first is to keep it bureaucratically incredibly simple. So you don't need, you know, various tiers and stuff. You just go in and you just vaccinate entire buildings. Exactly as Laura said, you know, you don't have to have a DR in front of your name to transmit the virus. So, you know, just vaccinate everyone who might come into contact with a patient, and, you know, from the receptionists and the cleaners and everyone, and make sure that everyone's fine. And the other major point to make is that they brute forced it, if you like. So they just ran it out across every across every service all of the time. I don't know that it's exactly correct to compare Israel's experience with ours for two reasons. The first is that, you know, they acted independently. They paid a premium price for the vaccine. before anyone else. And that's another major point that I'd like to make, which is that, you know, when we talk about getting the vaccine, we have to understand that in its international context, the top 10 richest countries in the world are the ones who are hoovering up most of the early supply of the vaccine. And so we are privileging the rich countries of the world against the poor. And that goes as far as within the European Union. And so, for example, Germany, which has a proportional allocation of the vaccine like every other country, actually paid over the odds again for another side deal for more vaccine, which is, of course, not conducive to increasing solidarity.
I think, though, a lot of what they got was allocations for other European countries that then said, we don't want it. And Germany said, we'll take up that unused allocation.
Indeed. There was an initial excess supply. But again, does that need to go to Germany, or could it go to one of the poorer countries of the world? There's always choices to be made here, and I think it's very important that we understand this in its international context. But I just agree with Mark that the league table thing is silly. What we should look at every single day is, and Luke O'Neill has a great piece in the Sunday Independent on page 8 about this, is we should be looking every day at the cumulative increase in the number of people vaccinated first time, and then obviously second time, and then look at the rate of that change. So how fast are we getting people sorted? A date that I would look at is the 12th of March. That's when the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar effectively began announcing the lockdown of the country. The target is that there's going to be 700,000 people vaccinated by the end of March. And so the 24th of March is when we actually close all the schools and everything like that. It would be brilliant if we could beat that 700,000 number, because that number is... the people, the very spear tip, the people who are really, really at risk, and healthcare workers and the elderly and the vulnerable. You know, we should start seeing the death rate fall much, much, much faster, because those are the people who are much more likely to die in the first place. Yeah. That's really, like as a measure of policy success, you know, I really, really, really don't care how Denmark is doing. What I care about is, can we get it to those people to make sure that they don't die unnecessarily, because we actually have a vaccine to give them.
Okay. Listen, speaking of March, Laura, it looks like we're not going to be seeing schools go back possibly until March, not fully at least, even if then we're definitely like everything locked down again for the time being. How are you managing? You've small children?
So I do. I've three small children, two of whom are in school. I'm sure, Brendan, you're the same. Like, it's been a tough year on the kids. It's been a misery. For us at work, so on a personal level, we have a childminder. There's no other way we could do it. The two are we're trying our best at the homeschooling. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully we'll all still be verbal by the end of this. I suppose from a healthcare perspective, what the school thing has done, and this isn't a criticism of anybody, is it has added to our massive staff shortages. So the fact that we have, you know, say somewhere between 4,000 and 7,000 healthcare workers out due to either COVID or COVID contacts or due to cocooning. And then on top of that, we now have people who have no alternative but to be at home to homeschool their children. And most of what we do in healthcare can't be done remotely. So
do you think that schools should be there for healthcare workers?
I would absolutely love to see that, so that we could somehow try and plug the gaps and perhaps not need to use the contact derogation. So we're bringing, at the moment, places are having to bring back in people who are COVID contacts because they have to plug gaps. If it was a scenario where we didn't have the additional pressures of people being off because of childcare, I think that it would be very helpful in terms of making our staffing safer and our patients safer in turn.
So okay, I know the vaccination is not a reward, but if we want to keep schools open, then would you move teachers up the list?
I would love to see the teachers vaccinated, and I don't know that they have called loudly enough for that. The data on vaccination really is very good. I mean, some of the vaccines are up past 95% protection after the second dose,
dose. Who do you move down the list, I suppose, is the question, if you move teachers up. But you think teachers, of all the, we have the lawyers out as well today looking for to be moved up. Do you think of all the groups who are looking to be moved up, teachers are the ones we should consider?
So from like I'm being I do have a selfish there is a selfish angle at this. I think getting the schools back is a massive coup for society, and if that's what it takes to get the schools back, I'd be pro it. I suppose, Brendan, I'm kind of hoping that the next vaccine is going to come out, the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. We're going to have tons of it. It's going to be in every pharmacy on every corner, and that people will pop in and get it. So I'm really hopeful that we're going to see a kind of a really big sea change with this once the next vaccine, the end of January, once they get approval for this and we start seeing large quantities coming in. So I'm really hopeful that supply is going to up and that we can start to do really like thoughtful and useful things like that. But at the moment, we're very limited by the stock that we have.
Yeah. Mark, how are you coping with lockdown? How's your business? Thriving or are you being affected?
It is actually, because we focus on trying to give early warning for misinformation about things like vaccines and a lot of the rhetoric. So we're watching out for places where we can stop false information spreading. And that's kind of the thing. It's really critical. There's an infodemic out there, according to the World Health Organization, where people are sharing information just wrong. And that's undermining things like vaccinations. For me personally, I have to say, you know, I collect stories of people who are doing really virtuous things or fantastic things in lockdown. So I'm just looking at the paper today, the Sunday Times, has two great stories about a kid of 11 years old writing a novel that's now been published and is doing really well. And an Irish DJ who's in the top 10 now.
Yes, top 10 in the UK.
Both bored at home. So I sort of identify with these hopeful things. And I think what's happened to me is I've had a bit of a sort of an addiction to virtuous stuff. So the gateway drug was the sourdough bread. I started that to begin with. And then that was like, that wasn't enough. And then I started the sea swimming. And then I realized at some point when someone said to me, it was a friend of mine actually yesterday said to me, you know, how do you know someone's a sea swimmer? Because they tell you.
Yeah.
And I realized I've just got to the point now where we're banning those conversation about these things. So I realize that all these now virtuous things I'm doing, just stop talking about them, do them.
Yeah, okay.
But that's been
all
my
right,
life.
We'll stop talking about it. Stephen Kinsella, not everyone is making sourdough and sea swimming, obviously. We have a massive swathe of the population, largely, I would say, young and lower paid people with fewer prospects. Have been out of work now, some of them, like, you know, on and off since last March. And like you hear there about hospitality this year and everything. These are not pretty times ahead economically and not pretty times for those people.
No, they're not. You know, the clear messaging from the government is that the lockdown period will last beyond the end of January. And, you know, you don't need a PhD to figure that out, right? The numbers don't support opening the economy up. And, you know, if we keep everything shut until March, effectively until the vaccine really takes hold, right? So we've moved to a much more closed down version of the economy. Now, what we've learnt of the last 9 or 10 months is that the government's capacity to support the economy is far greater than we had initially assumed. People like me were assuming that the government deficit would be 30 billion plus. It's about 19 billion. The income tax levels have held up strongly. We've been able to support upwards of 1.6 million people at the height of the first wave. You know, liquidations of businesses have actually gone down, not up, since the start.
But there's got to be businesses that have managed to survive this far, but like won't get much further, is there? We can't keep this up indefinitely, can we?
Well, no, nobody's suggesting we will. And in fact, Pascal Donoghue, wearing his other hat of the president of the Eurogroup, has actually said, you know, we actually need to get stimulus money out to the European member states as quickly as possible. So the European Union has 750 billion of a stimulus package ready to go. So a bit like Joe Biden's 1.9 trillion. And his point was, we just speed is of the essence. And that's absolutely true. With any stimulus package, you need three things: speed, scale, and scope. And if you don't get the speed, the other two don't matter. So my feeling about the Irish economy actually is far more optimistic than it was even 6 months ago.
Is it? Why so?
Well, I think just the data, just the show the level of resilience in the public finances, in the balance sheets of private sector firms, in the way that transaction volumes have held up. You know, the reality of the situation is we can hold the economy in its current position and in its current, if you like, stasis for at least another 6 to 8 months, you know. And I think what's really clear is that there is no trade-off between the economy and saving lives. Naively, we assumed that there was, you know, back as far as March, some of the, you know, the world's most prominent economists were saying there is a trade-off. The data show empirically there's absolutely not. There is no trade-off between people's lives and the economy. You sort people's health out first, the economy will come back. We can borrow at low interest rates for very, very long periods of time. Okay, the stock of debt is a problem, but realistically, can we hold this out until the vaccine takes hold? Absolutely.
Okay, we can on the macro.
On the macro.
Huge damage being done on the micro, though, isn't there? Like, and there will be scars after this, won't there?
There are always scars to crises, Brendan. There's still scars in the economy caused by the austerity program from 2011 to 2014, you know. And those are just unavoidable. But again, what we've learned is that the policy system can actually cope with kind of helping a lot of it keep going. And then, you know, we shouldn't underestimate, as Mark said, the agency of individual the agency of individual businesses. You know, lots of people are getting out there. They're producing their stuff from vans now. You're ordering stuff through Facebook or other services. And,
yeah.
And you know, like people are they're adapting. They're overcoming. They're responding. And I think to the greatest extent possible, we are coping. And I think the fact that we are coping is just a really, you know, we're not just coping, we're doing quite well relative to many other countries.
Okay.
And I think it's an optimistic lesson.
Okay, listen, I'm actually going to ask the panel to stay on over 12 because we do want to talk about Trump as well. But right now we'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You know, if we had the time, you know what we should do? We should have a citizens' assembly on vaccination because everyone has an opinion, right? You could get years out of it, right? So, for example, texter here, Mary, says, I'm 70. I've no problem staying at home and wait until teachers and young people are vaccinated. But then, on the other hand, another texter, why should a 25-year-old teacher be vaccinated before a 60-year-old grocery checkout operator? Age should determine priority. So there you go. Like, the combinations and permutations are endless. I think, if I understood that Israeli thing correctly, I think they're going along a very simple line of you vaccinate the people most likely to die first and you just keep it as simple as that, and that way you bring down deaths, which is the ultimate. Laura, I'm sorry, I should say our panel are still with us. I'm just keeping them for another little while. Dr. Laura Durkin, Mark Little and Stephen Kinsella. Laura, I just wanted, before we get on to Trump and America, there's a lot of talk about ICU now, and a lot of kind of, I suppose it's quite alarming for a lot of people. There's a lot of stuff in the papers, quite graphic stuff about very, very sick people coming in and everything. What are your thoughts on all that?
So, you know, ICU capacity in Ireland has been a problem for, you know, there's reports to the early 2000s that we had half the number of ICU beds that we should have. That's been a long-standing issue. And I suppose it has become very critical over the course of COVID. But if you look at the numbers that they just said in the news there, so we've around 2,000 inpatients with COVID, about 10% of those people are in ICU. The remaining 90% of our COVID patients are getting care on the ward. And I suppose for most people who are admitted to the hospital, COVID care comprises oxygen, which is going to be a huge issue nationally, that we keep our oxygen supply and our pipes, and that it's a really simple thing, but it's going to be, you know, that can be a challenge. And they need oxygen, a little bit of steroids and the tincture of thyme. And the problem, and they can be really sick and miserable, but the problem, Brendan, is unlike other illnesses that we can turn around pretty fast, COVID is not quick. So we're looking at lengths of stay on average of 2 weeks for a sick COVID person coming into the hospital. And that would be very much longer than, say, anyone who comes in with pneumonia or previous years, the flu or an exacerbation of their COPD. So for every bottom that lands in a hospital bed. We're looking at a pretty prolonged hospital stay. And so a huge challenge that's going to be for us going forward is, aside from the ICU, which is the, you know, the sharp end of the stick, the 10%, is going to be the finding capacity for the 90% of people who are just going to need a hospital bed for up to and perhaps longer than the 2 weeks. And that's going to be a big challenge going forward. And I'd love to hear, you know, I hope that most patients recognise that that is essentially how the hospital course goes for COVID. You know, horrible respiratory symptoms, GI issues, fevers, but that it is that, and that ICU is not suitable for all people who come in with COVID, and it is really the minority of our hospital care is happening in the intensive care unit. The vast majority of it is happening on COVID wards, which are regular hospital wards, and that's going to become a problem in the coming weeks, I think.
Okay, but I think it's also helpful to maybe give people a little bit of perspective. I know we all need, the more frightened we are, the more we stay at home, but at the same time, thank you for that, Laura. Now, obviously, a huge moment, I suppose, in America next week. I've already had my card marked, by the way, but from Jill has texted in. Before you talk about Trump, it's important to note that almost 70 million voted for him, and they are not all insurrectionists and rioters. Many are moderate Republicans. And Jill, absolutely take your point on that one. I don't know if the 69 million of them are moderate Republicans. I don't know how many of them are voting for Donald Trump again next week. But anyway, Mark Little, America is going to be second home to you for a while. What's your feeling as we stand on this precipice now?
It's funny. I mean, it's impossible for me to just remember back, you know, to 2008. I was on the mall in Washington watching Barack Obama. Yes, we can. Biden beside him. A million people there watching this man and having the sense of real hope. And 8 years later, then Donald Trump arrives along. You know, so the false dawn of Obama, where essentially is you compare to this week, where we'll have an inauguration that will not be a million people. It will be probably almost virtual because of COVID. It will be in a Washington that will be circled with a ring of 15,000 troops. They're talking about Washington being the green zone this week with the inauguration to protect against potential attack by these militia groups. So when Biden gets up to speak on Wednesday, he'll talk about America United. That's the theme of his inauguration speech. Mm-hmm. But he will be representing an America diminished. And by everything that's happened to him in the past, you'd say 8 years, maybe, but also with COVID happening as well. At the same time, he may be the luckiest president of modern times.
Oh, yeah. Take anything over when it's on the floor, like, and you
absolutely
can only do well.
And,
yeah,
you know, Stephen mentioned this earlier on. We may be going into a bounce back for the American economy, the world economy. So he's got that potentially. He's got a stimulus package. And most of all, he has an American people. And the texter's right. You know, a lot of those people were moderates making, you know, what seems to us maybe irrational decisions about supporting Trump for very rational reasons. But this week, it's kind of like, I think last 2 weeks, a fever has broken. The toxic element in American politics was just exposed dramatically. And I think a lot of the people that supported Trump and may even have voted for them have backed away a little bit. And I think there is a moment now for Biden to stand up and give a speech on Wednesday that signals the beginning of a recovery. But the problem is Biden is not necessarily the greatest orator. And there's going to be a huge amount of pressure for him to seem like the father of the nation, the person who can bring us forward. And that's not necessarily his strong suit in the past. So massive pressure on him. Whether or not it's peaceful, I very much hope it will be given the security measures. But the problem in many ways is the toxin is still there. Trump may go to Mar-a-Lago. He's not going to be in Washington to do the usual, you know, they exchange greetings in the Oval Office. He's going off sulking. But he leaves behind a particularly toxic and virulent strain of populism.
Yeah,
that even if it
which he did not invent, we should say, you know, and even talking to Richard Ford last week or the week before, you know, America has always had ebbs and flows of various kinds of poisons.
The biggest act of terrorism in American history was the Oklahoma bombing. Was a militia member caused that back in the 80s. So you're right, and it goes right back in some fantastic reporting done on Nixon and Reagan and where they came from. So it's always been there in the American psyche. It's that darkness that's always been a little invisible most of the time, and it's become visible. And it's also become more virulent because of a lot of other factors, including, for example, the online culture we have.
Yeah. Now, so before we go to the others, obviously that's kind of your area. And it does feel as well like that something, is the fever breaking there in terms of the internet and what we will tolerate online and everything?
Yeah, there's been a clarity. I mean, for the reasons the internet spreads lies and misinformation, not to do with the business model underlying it, the algorithms that are there, but we've recognized that we've got to make decisions. We've got to make hard decisions. I agree with Jack Dorsey and Zuckerberg when they ban Trump.
Okay, so what, do we start banning people we don't agree with?
No, we do this. You have free speech, but just like you can't go into the classic free speech argument, you can't go to a cinema and shout fire. You cannot tell lies that incite violence and claim free speech around that. There are limits, and there's a clear limit when a political leader uses a platform like Twitter to lie and incite violence. That's a clear decision. Now, that has to be applied consistently by these platforms. The worrying part is the decisions about free speech have been taken by billionaires in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And that's the
problem. Guys like you who got lucky, like with tech companies.
And I can tell you right now, right? I don't have any, I carry water for Twitter, but I know the people in the platforms don't want that responsibility. So I'd be very interested in the European.
And they're uniquely unqualified and unchosen to run the world.
I mean, okay? I'm lucky enough to work with Jack Dorsey and know him, and you know, no better person to think philosophically about the decisions he's taken. Having said that, he, I think, and all those people want new rules that would allow some sort of oversight and adjudication of these decisions.
Yeah,
and Europe actually will probably take the lead on this with this Digital Services Act, where we're going to see people being able, you know, oppose a decision to ban them, for example, and that be out in the open, possibly adjudicated by courts. And what really excites me is the idea that we'll actually be in Ireland, probably at the tip of the spear of this, because obviously all the platforms are here.
Yeah.
There's huge innovation going on here, and I hopefully represent that. And also the regulator here will be the first regulator to try and sort through a lot of these new regulations that, including Biden, will introduce probably very quickly in the new presidency.
Stephen Kinsler, no more than Jack Dorsey shouldn't be running the world. Are we able for this in Ireland? Do we have the basic staffing and resources to be doing this? And should we be the ones doing this?
Well, I think if the companies are located here, we're duty bound to do this. If the regulator needs more funds, then she should ask for them. And I hope they'll be given. One of the key issues that we have is that, you know, you've got people like Angela Merkel saying it is not appropriate for a private company to decide whether a political leader's speech can be censored or not. I agree as well. I think Trump's speech, you know, ultimately his speech was for years was essentially about intolerance. And if you tolerate intolerance, things go badly for you, as Karl Popper told us years ago. So I think, you know, better regulations around this would be better and would also provide a framework for companies to hang their hats on. I do believe, as Mark said, we're moving into an era where, you know, we've realized the damage that can be done. And I think it's, you know, if COVID teaches us anything, it teaches us that, you know, a maximal state can sort of assert itself in very interesting ways. And I think particularly in this arena.
Yeah. It took Jack Dorsey a long time, I must say, to figure out the damage that was being done, didn't it? It's funny how it was only finally when everybody was bailing on Trump and he was kind of, you know, a man of straw, more or less, towards the end, that was when the plug got pulled.
Oh, that's simply cowardice.
That's
all that is.
Yeah. Justine McCarthy has a great piece today, actually. I was only thinking it myself last night. I was looking at CNN and I was thinking, CNN is now a parody of itself. And actually, Janan Ganesh, who's a great columnist, is writing about this during the week. Broadcast media news and the need to fill 24 hours a day hasn't been any friend to rational kind of political discussion.
I was remembering, like, Trump is a TV president, right? He was the ratings guy who got the ratings in NBC. CNN made a lot of money, and CBS president at the time said he was good for their business. So he was created by television. And in many ways, his rise, his ascent was to do with the idea that television is competing for the eyeballs.
Yeah.
And he was good business. Now, I don't say that in any way, I've already established that online culture helped accelerate the poison. But you have to remember, like, he was the TV man. He was the guy who was running ratings. And therefore, there is a certain culpability for a lot of the TV and print as well, journalism, attacking online culture, when in fact, they've been trapped in that ratings war as well. Not for a choice, but so there's quite a bit of truth, I think, in what Justine's saying today.
Yeah. John here texts to say, unfortunately, many of that 72 million who voted for Trump are worried by a Democratic Party, which they see as increasingly influenced by extreme elements of the left. President Biden really has to win the middle view quickly. And that's, I think that's a very fair point, isn't it? Laura, you lived in America at one stage, didn't you?
Yeah, we lived just up the road from Washington, D.C. And I used to love going to the mall and sitting and having a picnic. And it was such a fabulous place. And it was such a beautiful, like Obama was the president, and it was, you know, the table of democracy, and it was inspirational. So I don't know, like, I feel sorry for Joe Biden because we're still talking about Donald, you know, and I don't know when that will happen. And the chances are in the next few months, he's going to be pretty boring. He's bad TV. He's not going to be exciting Twitter. You know, we're not going to be stuck to CNN watching to see what he does next. And I hope that people forgive him that, because he's just going to be the president and do his job, I hope. But it's going to be pretty, I think, vanilla compared to what's gone before. And I hope.
Yeah, but I think actually there somebody has actually looked at the pattern here, and that apparently after you have a dramatic president of America, you then do go for people like to have a Jimmy Carter or something, and somebody who's a bit easier on the nerves, so to speak. Like, I think, you know, there's a lot of people saying they're exhausted now.
Yeah.
Imagine if we didn't have to think about Joe Biden at all. if America just ran itself without us having to worry about it every week.
I mean, and Barack Obama to fix it for them. Was at his strongest when he was no drama Obama. Like, internally, his people knew that. And I think part of the problem is you can raise Jimmy Carter. Like, there's also that specter, you know, that we have this most ineffective person who has his own party riven by conflict. And halfway through, we all go, oh my God, like there still is that toxin there. And that, you know, look at what happened with Carter. And I think that's the only fear I would have, is Biden himself is not necessarily the person you would design if you were designing a president to take advantage of this opportunity.
If you were designing a president to take advantage of this, you might actually design Kamala Harris, mightn't you?
Well, remember, that's one of the issues, is you have a very strong VP there, which is probably something.
I think you get the impression, or I don't know Joe, but you get the impression that he is accepting that she is going to be maybe a big part of this presidency.
Yeah, and I think that the choice was really, really targeted. But, you know, you have to also remember that America's changing quite dramatically, ways we don't discuss in terms of demographics. Like, have Georgia is now Democrat. Can you imagine? The Deep South, it's now shifting. And it's reflecting a much younger population, much more diverse. And also, there is a moderation in some parts of the United States around the big cities. So I think he will benefit from that. And that's Kamala Harris is the epitome. She is literally the reflection of that changing America. So it's not by any accident that he's chosen someone that reflects the change in America that we saw in places like Georgia.
Okay, well, look, we will be, like the Skibbereen Eagle, we will be keeping an eye on this. So let's hope Wednesday goes well, and let's hope we can stop talking about Donald John Trump for a while then. Thank you very much to my panel today, Dr. Laura Durkin, Mark Little and Stephen Kinsella, and thank you for staying on a little bit there. I think it was well worth it. And listen, never mind the philosophical stylings of Jack Dorsey. After the break, we will have that great philosopher, Michael Harding.
Email brendan@rte.ie.